Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke. This is the October 27th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, welcome aboard, everyone, again as we gather for this hour of discussion concerning all things related to our nation's space program, and where today we're going to be focusing on something pretty neat, I think. It's the efforts of a University of Central Florida-based team, Go Knights, to land a small robot on the moon before the end of 2015, and perhaps if their first take home a prize of perhaps $20 million or more. It's all part of the Google Lunar X Prize. And a gentleman named Joe Pelea is scheduled to give us a call here shortly. From Earthrise Space, the company kind of overseeing the effort, the team name Omega Envoy. So we're going to do all that with him. We're going to also tell you the latest, what we have on when the next launch is from the Cape. Some more delays there. We'll talk about it later in the program. We'll also try again our second installment of what we're now calling Terminal Count, which is our newest addition to the program that I hope you'll enjoy again later in the show. We also invite you to call in today, this live program on a blustery day as the Hurricane Sandy's out there to the east of us. Let us know what's on your mind today about the space program. Perhaps you have a question about space flight or would like to make a comment or something about a question or so about what we're discussing. Give us a call. 321-768-1240. You can also send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. We'll try to get to you as quickly as possible. Well, usually we do some kind of commentary piece right now. Our broadcast blog we call Orbital Inclinations. We're going to do something a little different here today. We're going to share a story with you that we're going to entitle Adventures in Model Rocketry. And to help me share that tale with you, on the phone with me is my good friend Patrick McCarthy, who by day in his secret identity is the director of spaceport operations at Space Florida, but who in real life we all know is a nationally acclaimed award-winning model rocketeer and who was with me last Sunday when all of this went down. Pat, good afternoon. How you doing today?
Doing great today, Jim. How are you?
Well, still recovering after last weekend's traumatic events.
Indeed. I was glad I was there to help out, though.
Yeah, not just all but short of holding my hand through the whole thing. So let's set the stage, and then we'll kind of share and tell them the story. Some of you out there in listener land may be familiar with the Honest John story. The Honest John story, retold quickly, is my first attempt at launching a model rocket when I was a little kid back in Minnesota. Probably about 10 or 11 years old, about 40 years ago. And we had gotten this model rocket as a present from Mom and Dad, and it was winter time, and so we were in Minnesota, and we were anxious to get it to flying, and we were waiting for the weather to clear, for the spring weather to come in Minnesota, and it was a windy, blustery day in Minnesota, and I probably shouldn't have launched the rocket, but I definitely thought that we wanted to get it off the ground. And, of course, wanted to make sure that we had as high pressure, high power as possible. We couldn't just do a small engine. We had to put the biggest engine in it. And we did all that, and we launched it, and it went out of sight, and we never saw it again. Now, I had a fairly successful career in model rocketry after that. Always wanted to refly this thing. Finally bought a new Honest John on eBay. It's a Cox model rocket, plastic, small little thing, about a little shy of a foot. Got it all prepped to go. Return to flight of me flying model rockets after probably about 15 years. Pat McCarthy, you were sitting there. I was taking video. You were pushing the button. You counted it down, and tell us what happened.
Well, let's see. We had a nominal engine start. The ignition went right on T0. And I guess the rocket got up to about 3 or 4 feet in the air when we suffered an engine failure of some sort on our purchased engine, you know, which, of course, you can buy at any hobby shop. And the rocket disassembled itself, as us model rocketeers say. It went into a rapid disassembly incident. It re-kitted itself. Although, I must say that, you know, being a... I'm more of a purist, you know, and this was, as we say, a ready-to-fly rocket. So it wasn't really intended to come back apart, but it did. And then we sort of scattered the pieces around near the launch pad there, and all safe, of course, because it was, you know, the required 15 feet away from us.
Well, sure.
You know, the parachute came out, and the nose cone landed nice and soft.
After trying, you know, flying an incredible maybe 10 feet in the air.
That's right. That's right. So the anticipation was very high, and the payoff was less than expected.
So like in Apollo 13, where sometimes we say it exploded, and other people will say, well, it didn't explode, it ruptured. Our Honest John rocket essentially ruptured. The little solid-propelled engine basically, what, blew all of its thrust forward, and the body of the rocket couldn't contain it, so it kind of split.
That's right. It overpressurized the body and popped the two pieces of the body apart and then pushed the nose cone off.
And again, as you say, safety-wise, you know, we're 10, 15 feet away. And this is not a huge deal. This is not like a firework barge blowing up or anything. So I don't want to get anyone the impression that there was shrapnel flying all over or anything like that. This was a non-event explosively, but nevertheless a traumatic event emotionally.
Yes, it was. And, Mike and I were there to help out, and we were, you know, we did not have to revive you, although you were... You were literally stunned for a few minutes there. It's like, you know, 40 years, and then to have this happen. You know.
and we did recover, and we're talking about our friend Mike Myrick, who was out there with us, also documenting the disaster as it unfolded. But the pieces were able to be recovered. I want everyone to know that we have everything in hand. We were able to recover everything. Everything broke more or less cleanly, so with a little super glue. And perhaps some tape, we should be able to reassemble this thing and try again, you know, in another couple of weeks, perhaps when we get emotionally ready and strong enough to handle this again.
That's right. We're going to have to, after the therapy, you'll be ready to go again.
That's right. No physical therapy or occupational therapy. This will all be couch stuff. But and of course, that was just the first launch. Now, we had some successes. That was great. But we had a couple other stories that maybe we ought to share, too. And the first one, perhaps the first one being the Falcon 9.
That's right. Well, you know, you had that great little scale model of the Falcon 9 that you can buy online from SpaceX, and it looks, it's about 18 inches tall, and it looks just like the Falcon 9 with the little Dragon capsule on top of it.
Yep.
And, you know, we loaded that up with a Quest model rocket motor, and what was it, a B64, I think which is about
right.
The perfect size for that. You loaded the igniter in, the electric igniter.
I did.
We put it on the pad. It got its 5-second terminal count. We pressed the button, and we got the little puff of smoke that says the igniter's burning, and we were all ready for it to go, and then it just sat.
And then and we all heard NASA's George Dillard's voice calling off, liftoff, and no, we've had a cutoff. So just like the real Falcon 9 on its second, well, I guess it would have been its third launch, but the one earlier this year that aborted on the pad, we had ourselves an honest-to-God SpaceX abort on the launch pad.
That's right, and, you know, you could not have... It could not have modeled real life any more accurately than that.
That's right. So we quickly, just like SpaceX, quickly turned it around, figured out the problem, solved it, reset the igniter, launched it, and it was an absolute complete success.
That's right. It was a perfect flight thereafter.
And we had some other good flights as well, too. So anyway, so that's the quick story. Pat, thanks for joining us. You got a busy afternoon. We'll say goodbye to you now.
You're welcome, Jim.
Okay,
take
see you,
care.
Pat. All right, thanks. So anyway, so yeah, Honest John was tough. The Falcon 9 flew great. We had a Delta IV EFT-1 model rocket from Dr. Zuch model rockets that flew as well. It was really great. So anyway, hey, we're going to be back now to talk about Google Lunar X Prize in just a few moments. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240, the number to call. To participate in your program today, you can also send your questions or comments to us in an email at spacetalking@aol.com. By the way, we had some great model rocket launches. Besides, we had the Honest John fail on us, but we had a great Falcon 9 flight, a great EFT-1 flight of a Dr. Zuch model rocket. Had a couple other smaller ones, bigger ones, some Estes rockets that flew. We had one little rocket that took off and went out of sight. We thought we lost it. And then we drove down behind some trees where we thought it might be, and there it was laying right there in the middle of a small street, and it was just a great find there, too. It was a great day flying model rockets. It's a great hobby. I haven't done it in, like I say, about 15 years, and I miss it dearly. Was glad to be back, and like I say, we're going to fix up this Honest John and fly it again. A busy week in real space, too, by the way. New crew launched the International Space Station this past week, and they're safely on board. The Dragon spacecraft that we talked about earlier is going to be unberthed from the space station tomorrow morning and head back home for a splashdown in the Pacific. South Korea tried to launch one of their rockets for the third try. They've tried to get this rocket off the ground. It's scrubbed. China launched a navigation satellite. A Russian upper stage exploded in space and caused a bunch of orbital debris. So, I mean, it's just who says our spaceflight program is not happening right now? I certainly don't, and I don't think the gentleman that's joining us today to talk with the rest of the program is concerned too much about the lack of spaceflight activity. Joe Pelaya is with the COO of Earthrise Space Incorporated, and he'll tell us a little bit more here about exactly how that all fits into what we're talking about today, which is the Google Lunar X Prize. The UCF has a team, or at least a UCF-based team, shooting for this incredible opportunity to put a robot on the moon. We're going to talk about that today with Joe. Joe joins us. Joe, I think you're in Orlando, aren't you?
Yes, we're over here right in Research Park near UCF.
Oh, sure. No, right where that is. So you're not getting, I hope it's not too windy over there right now. It surely is here on the coast.
Not too bad.
Well, tell us, first of all, how you come to the job that you're in now and kind of what your interest in the space program is. Tell us a little bit about yourself, as it were.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess if you asked my mother that question, she'd tell you that she was reading the Scientific American before I could talk. So I guess I got it from an early age. But I've been involved in various space ventures here in Florida for a number of years. I actually hooked up with some investors when I was up at MIT doing my grad work, and that's what ended up bringing me to Florida. But I've done everything from spend a month up in the Arctic at a simulated Mars base, being astronaut, to working with a group looking at what the first permanent settlement on Mars might look like. And back in January, these guys here at Earthrise were looking for somebody to come in and help crack the whip and really accelerate their program, and I took them up on the challenge.
And so here you are. Now, when you talked about that Mars stuff, it reminded me that there was for a time out at the KSC Visitor Complex, one of these simulated Mars habitats that at least was on display. And this was probably going back, well, maybe 10 years now. I wondered if you had anything to do with that, because that was also similar to one that they said was in the, in the Antarctic, I think, that they used, or at least in some.
Well, that's correct. So that particular habitat was the Mars Desert Research Station. And that was built by the nonprofit Mars Society. And they had that on display there at the Kennedy Space Center for a while, and then they went and deployed that out in the desert in Utah. It's actually the sister station to that station, very similar in design. It was built just before that, that's up in the Arctic on Devon Island. And the one that I got to spend a month up in, playing astronaut and learning a lot about what it would really take to have people on Mars in a small, group, one of the initial groups, doing some science and some engineering investigations.
You know, we spend so much time talking about, the big high-profile groups. We know what NASA's doing. We know what the military more or less is doing. We certainly are keyed in now on the commercial world, SpaceX and all of that. But there's so many of these other little research efforts that go on, like what you just talked about, and even what this whole Google Lunar X Prize is all about.
in terms of people really working hard behind the scenes in small groups and small budgets to do something incredible. And I wonder if you could just tell us sort of, let's start with the big picture about what Google Lunar X Prize is all about, and then we'll get into the very specific folks that you guys are working on with Omega Envoy.
Sure. Well, let me just throw out first that we call this effect that you're talking about the Iron Man effect. If you've seen the movie, you see him, Tony Stark is developing the Iron Man suit, and he's got his own very interactive computer there, very sophisticated software, and he's able to do some amazing things in terms of design and development of hardware.
Yeah.
Well, that's essentially the capability that we have today, very close to it. The software capabilities have advanced so rapidly that it no longer takes, buildings full of engineers to design and build spacecraft. I mean, we can do it very effectively using these tools and a relatively small group of people. So over at Earthrise, we have about 40 people on board, and we're going after the Google Lunar X Prize. So what's the Google Lunar X Prize?
Right.
Well, it's a $30 million competition. Google has put up the purse. It's run by the X Prize Foundation. So this is Peter Diamandis and that same group out in St. Louis that funded the first X Prize, the Antares X Prize.
Which was the first human in a suborbit privately put into space, their own astronaut.
Exactly. Bert Rutan's team with Paul Allen over there won that. So this is a follow-on prize, and they actually have a whole series of these things. They have a genomics prize, a tricorder prize, and then they have the Google Lunar X Prize. So it's a $30 million competition, the first non-governmental team to land a spacecraft on the moon, have it travel 500 meters across the surface, and send back HD video, a text message, and an email. And if you do that, you win $20 million. Then there's all these bonus prizes if you take some, that money shot of the first footprint, Neil Armstrong's first footprint, or of the flag there on the lunar surface, or if you travel further, you survive a lunar night. There's all these different bonus prizes where you can win some additional money.
Right. So an incredible, it sounds great. It's been going on for a while. I know the deadline right now, what the last I heard was get this done by the end of 2015.
That's correct.
Are there folks that are going to make it?
Well, I think that they'll be going to – it's actually going to be quite exciting. I think there's going to be a couple different teams that are going to give it a go. And it's going to get very exciting here near the end as the teams try to jockey for who's going to launch first and who's going to be able to get their hardware together. I know that some folks have come out and said that, if you don't have a launch vehicle lined up by right now, that you really can't be credible at this. And that's true to a certain extent. The caveat is if your spacecraft is small enough that you can be a piggyback payload, you're not the primary payload on this rocket, but you're a secondary payload, then there's not the strict requirement in terms of lead time. So that's what we're looking at in terms of Earthrise Space. We have a relatively small spacecraft, and we're going to nuzzle it up underneath some commercial satellite or other primary payload, and then shoot off to the moon.
Now, we'll talk some specifics here in a few moments, but part of the feature of this XPRIZE in general is very much divorced from kind of any government help. The government, I think, can be a customer if you offer services to raise money, but they can't. NASA just can't come and give you $100 million to go make this happen.
Correct. Now, there are some caveats. I think that you can have up to 10%. Something like 10% can be government funded, and then you're correct. If NASA is a customer, that's okay. And one example of that is NASA came out with this contract they call the Innovative Lunar Demonstrations Data Contract.
Yeah.
And it was basically to encourage these U.S.-based teams in the Google Lunar X Prize. So a number of teams went after it. There were six that were awarded it. We were one of those six. So it's the idea that NASA sees that these teams are doing this in a different way than traditionally how the government or how NASA has done it. And so they want to learn from that. And so they're putting up money in pieces up to a total of $10 million to buy this data and this know-how from these companies.
Mm-hmm.
So we've already won about 110,000 of that so far. And as NASA comes out with other additional pieces of that you can go after, we're going to go after that.
Now, prizes have an incredible history in aviation to make things happen. Certainly Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic was one of the most famous ones. And I don't know if it's you call it a the critics say this, but people do kind of wonder, you know, well, if you're going for a prize of $20 million, but it's going to cost you $50 million to do it, then why do it? Why is this so important? Why are you going after this prize?
Well, there's a number of reasons, one of which is that obviously you have to have a business case that closes to do this. That's a prerequisite. The prize is kind of a nice, big, hairy, audacious goal out there to work towards. And if you win it, then, hey, you know, automatically your investors or your stakeholders get back a big chunk of what they put into it.
Yeah.
But I think if you talk to at least a lot of the U.S.-based companies that are going after this, they're all in this for the long haul. They're looking at developing a capability and proving a capability through this GLXP mission to deliver payloads to the lunar surface. And there are a lot of customers out there that are willing to pay to have their payload flown to the moon.
I think that's absolutely great. And it's all about the spirit of exploration as well. We'll talk some more about this with Joe Pelaya in just a few moments. We're going to take our five-minute built and hold, get you caught up on all the news, weather, and sports. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. The phone lines and online inbox is always open for your questions or comments. We're talking about the Google Lunar X Prize today with Joe Pelaya out of Orlando Earthrise Spaces. The name of the company, Omega Envoy, is the name of the team. The phone number to call to ask him or me a question, 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. So, Joe, we've established that what the Google Lunar X Prize is and kind of how it works. Can you tell us how many teams are you competing with? How big is this league?
Right. There's about 25 teams out there. I think there's six or seven in the U.S.
So a true international effort as well, if you will.
It is, in fact, and it's interesting because we're getting to a point in the competition where teams have to do some soul searching and decide, do they have critical mass to pull this off, or, you know, what are they going to do? And so some of the teams have started to merge. We saw just recently the MIT team was actually acquired by the Silicon Valley team. And then we had a big announcement recently. You know, I talked about customers are
right.
willing to pay to send their payloads to the moon. Well, we just recently announced a $1.6 million deal that we closed with the Chilean team in the competition. So they're
wow.
actually paying us to fly their rover to the moon on our spacecraft.
So, wow. So some real synergy going on there to get this to make this happen. So let's go through it in the 10 minutes we have together right now in this segment. Step by step, what is the Omega Envoy team? What's the UCF Knights, you know, version of all of this that we should be rooting for?
Sure. So we're about, oh, I'd say our headcount's about 40 people right now. And what really distinguishes our team from some of the others is that we are primarily students. So we have quite a few undergrad and graduate students. I'd say about 30 of the 40 members of our team are students. And so that what that means is that our cost structure is much, much lower than some of these other companies out there that are buying up senior engineers and have big staff. And we found that the performance of these students is really, really exceptional. So we were able to pull in the best and the brightest from UCF, FIT, Embry-Riddle, and we're able to pull them all together in our facility over in Research Park and really get a good dynamic going where these students are learning as they go. They feel really empowered because they're working on an incredible project, and they're put into positions of authority. So unlike, say, an internship at a big aerospace firm somewhere where you might be doing some menial task, here the students are put in charge of various aspects of the design and of the spacecraft.
Sure.
And then what we do is we pair them up with experts from the space industry here in Florida that have the experience and have the knowledge.
So you've got this team working together. To what extent are they doing the work? I mean, are they designing software, bending metal, welding parts together? I mean, how involved, how intricate is all this?
Well, a little bit of all of the above. So we have a full design capability with all the software in-house so that we're able to design the spacecraft, the various elements of it. We do analysis in-house, whether it be using Satellite Toolkit, SDK, for some of the orbital dynamics, or FEA software, where you analyze the structure of the vehicle, as well as other software packages. Then what we do is we have a whole design review process using these experts from industry to help provide that feedback and refine the design. We have a partner, Stratasys, that has provided us with a 3D printer, so we're actually able to print some of these parts and ABS plastic and hold them in our hand and get a sense for what they're going to be. And then we actually have a full machine shop right there in our facility. So we have manual lathes, mills, we have a three-axis CNC milling machine, as well as other capability. And so we're going to be manufacturing the parts there. We've got a quality assurance program in place. And we'll be doing assembly and testing also right there in-house.
It just sounds like a mini space program. Talk to us about the hardware. It's kind of hard to picture this. I mean, we in the public know more or less what the lunar module looks like and how it landed on the moon. We've certainly all lived through Curiosity recently, how it landed on Mars with its incredible 7 minutes of terror and all of the crazy things that went with that. We've seen Spirit and Opportunity land. We've seen things bounce on Mars with the balloons surrounding them, parachutes, rockets. What's the plan here for your group for Omega Envoy?
Sure. So thankfully, the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, and so that simplifies our task greatly as compared to the 7 minutes of terror that the spacecraft landing on Mars had gone through. But it's still a very challenging task to land something safely on the lunar surface.
Sure.
What we have is actually four different spacecraft that we're going to be developing. So these spacecraft get all bolted together into a payload stack, and they'll be launched to either LEO or GEO on a commercial rocket, so perhaps Falcon 9 or some other launch vehicle. So they spit us out into orbit. Then we have a TLI, or translunar injection stage. It's just a big solid rocket motor. Fires and shoots us off to the moon, and then we separate from that. Then when we get close to the moon, we have the LOI stage, the lunar orbit insertion stage. The big liquid propellant rocket motor stage, it fires, captures us into lunar orbit, and then we actually use that stage to do about 75-80% of the descent maneuver. And then we throw that away, and that ends up impacting the lunar surface. The third spacecraft is the LDV. The lunar descent vehicle.
Okay.
And so this is very much like what you're familiar with the LEM, spidery-looking thing with four landing legs and a rocket motor. And that comes down and gets us to our soft touchdown in the vicinity of Apollo 12. That's where we're headed for.
Okay.
And then there are two panels that open up on the side of the LDV that act as ramps, and our rover is inside and drives out onto the surface.
And just drives out. And this whole thing does not need a Saturn V. You mentioned the Falcon 9 as a possibility. This is all still relatively small hardware.
Correct. When we initially conceptualized the vehicle, we were planning on using a Falcon 1E as our launch vehicle.
Much smaller,
So that gives you a sense of scale. It's quite a small spacecraft, especially if you're looking at these very large communication satellites. Our spacecraft is quite tiny, so it shouldn't be any problem at all nestling in up underneath, say, some commercial satellite on a Falcon 9.
You know, you talked about landing at Apollo 12, and earlier you mentioned about capturing a picture of Neil Armstrong's boot print.
That would be at Apollo 12, but we could still capture some Apollo astronauts' footprints.
Well, that's what I was going to get at, because I know that there was a lot of concern, especially some of the folks that worked Apollo here, that that the Google Lunar X Prize was going to go up and mess up the lunar landing sites with all sorts of rover tracks over all this stuff. And I know that at least last I heard between sort of the space community and NASA and Congress looking to say Apollo 11 landing site off limits, Apollo 17 landing site off limits. But for something like what you guys want to do with Google Lunar X Prize, Apollo 12 is fair game, and why not? Let's, you know, Pete Conrad would love it if there was something commercial up there running around on his bootsteps.
Sure, and actually NASA is very interested in revisiting sites. I mean, you've got hardware up there that's been up there for decades. And so NASA is very interested in seeing how is this hardware survived over the long haul there on the lunar surface. So they've actually put out a set of guidelines, they call them recommendations, for entities that are going to go back to the moon with regards to how can we protect these sites because they're of, you know, obvious intrinsic historic value, but also how can we explore them in a way that, you know, we can get some interesting data back from them and we can go visit them, but we're not going to destroy them in the process.
Now, I'm, you know, this is, of course, a competition and a space race of sorts. And so I know you don't want to let, all, you know, the cat out of the bag on too many things, but can you give us a general sense of how far along are you in this whole process? And I don't know, can you say how close you think you are to setting a launch? Do you think you can make 2015?
Sure. Well, I can say that we definitely are in it to win it. And as far as if you look at all of the different competitors out there, I would hazard to say that we're in about third or fourth position right now. There are a couple of teams out there that are very well-heeled. They have a big, big industry behind them, and they've raised the lion's share of what they need in order to make this happen. I would estimate, based on both cash we've gotten in and in-kind contributions, we've raised about $2.5 million so far.
Wow.
For our project. So we're at the point where, you know, our designs are very mature. We vetted them through NASA as part of our NASA contract. And, you know, we're obviously refining those designs. But we're at the point now where we're bending metal. We're doing, you know, structural tests. In fact, we have a whole mock-up of our one-to-one scale of our lander, our LDV, built at this point. It's sitting in our shop.
Okay.
Within the next month or so, we're going to be doing drop tests on that.
Oh, wow.
So I can say that, you know, we're confident that we're going to pull this off. And that confidence doesn't just extend to us. That also extends to others out there. Obviously, otherwise, the Chileans wouldn't have signed a $1.6 million deal with us.
Yeah.
So we're moving forward aggressively, and we're going to make this happen.
With about 25 seconds before the next break, Joe, tell us real quick, how can the public help you do what you're doing and be a part of our Central Florida home team?
Well, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and so we encourage donations, large and small. Check out our website, the information to contribute is there. And also, there are other ways you can contribute, in kind, or if you have technical expertise, give us a ring, shoot us an email. We could put you to work.
Okay, Joe, stand by. We'll give you that contact information in a minute. We're going to do our next launch. We're going to play Terminal Count with Joe in a moment. We'll be back in just a couple of seconds here. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk. This is WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Bankey.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with your reminder that you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week. First stop, of course, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find an archive of all of our past Space Talk shows and text versions of Orbital Inclinations. You can also follow us on Twitter at Space Talking. We have a Space Talk page on Facebook. And, of course, your questions, comments, suggestions for the program, always welcome throughout the week at those various places online. Now we're going to take a look at, when we might expect the next launch from Cape Canaveral. And, unfortunately, that's a tough question to answer right now. Once again, since we met last weekend, the Air Force has moved to the right on the schedule. Its plans to launch the next X-37B orbital test vehicle on a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket Air Force and ULA now targeting November 13th as the launch date. So it slipped out beyond here in October and into the mid part of November. You may recall that on the last Delta IV rocket launch from the Cape at the beginning of October, the Centaur upper stage on that rocket had a problem with its RL-10 engine. Now, the satellite, which we don't know a lot about, well, I guess it was the GPS satellite, did make it into its proper orbit. But the Air Force and ULA want to understand exactly what went wrong, make sure that that problem won't repeat on the next Atlas V launch, which uses the, essentially the same upper stages on the Delta IV. So you got all these folks meeting and looking at the data and trying to sort it all out. And until that all gets done, keep November 13th penciled in as the date when we'll see our next launch. Of course, we'll keep you updated on that. By the way, in talking about this problem with that rocket, I want to make sure that everyone's not confused by the fact that the SpaceX Falcon 9 launch that carried Dragon to the space station here this month launched a few days after the Delta IV also had a problem during its climb to orbit, but completely unrelated to what the ULA team is working through right now with the Delta IV and the Atlas V. So anyway, for more information about this and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, you can jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keywords space talk. Look for the link to our launch forecast, and you'll see all the various schedules that are available and accurate online, including the best one at spaceflightnow.com. Well, to wrap up the program here, Joe Pelea from Earthrise Space in Orlando is talking to us today about the Google Lunar X Prize. And, Joe, two quick questions before we get to terminal count. And the first one is, explain real quick, what is the relationship? How, I should have said that. I should have asked you this at the beginning of the program. You have Earthrise Space Incorporated. You have the team named Omega Envoy. Is Earthrise Space basically the business entity that, that manages the team Omega Envoy? Is that how to characterize it?
Yeah, that's correct. So Omega Envoy is one of several projects that Earthrise Space is pursuing. There's a number of other projects either in action or in the works right now. One of them is we just won a grant from the Florida Space Grant Consortium to look at a high-altitude dust collection device.
Oh, really?
So, you know, Earthrise kind of has this mission of giving students experience, you know, designing, building, testing, and flying real space hardware. So that could be stuff that mounts on a jet plane and collects dust, or it could be spacecraft actually flying in space.
Wow, that's great. And again, just to make it clear, because we cut you off at the end of the last segment, how can the public help specifically? Can we go to a website? Can we give you a call? Give us the plug there.
Sure. Just visit our website. It's at earthrise-space.org, and all the information is on there. And we encourage everyone to check us out and get involved in some way.
You know, my son goes to school at UCF as a computer science major, and first of all, I got to talk to him about getting him on the team. But secondly, we got to see some Omega Envoy gear on sale in the bookstore over there, you know, with some Knights logos on it and all that, and proceeds goes towards supporting what you're doing. And we'll have to talk later. Okay,
yeah,
so
that's a great suggestion. We'll have to follow up on
that. Okay, terminal count, Joe. We started this last week. We just wanted to have a little fun in the couple of moments that we have remaining in our program today, with about 2 minutes here to go. I'm going to give you five questions. Give me your quick off-the-top of your head answers. We're going to learn a little bit more about you in the process. First question, coolest rocket?
Coolest rocket? I think it has to be the Falcon 9. I actually got to see it out for the prototype flight, which was a night launch, and that was spectacular.
That's great. There you go. First launch you saw or remember? The first launch you saw or best remember?
Well, that was actually a shuttle launch a couple years ago. So.
In person. Okay. All right. Most prized space memorabilia. I'm sure you're going to want that lunar soil someday, but most prized space memorabilia.
I have to say I'm actually going to be dressed up as Spock for Halloween this year, so I'd say my tricorder.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Best space TV series or movie?
That's a tough one. Well, I grew up watching Star Trek, so I'd have to say Star Trek.
I grew up, so let's, how old are you? Was that an original Star Trek or Next Generation Star Trek?
Original Star Trek and reruns. I was born in 79.
So. Okay. Well, see, and I was the same way. I was old enough to remember the first run Star Trek, like in the last season, just before the Apollo 11 landing. And then after that, it was all reruns for years and years and years. Okay, last question. Moon, Mars, or beyond?
My colleagues at Earthrise joke that I'm a resident Martian because that's really my ambition. I want to see a permanent settlement on Mars. So I tell people that Mars is my passion and the moon is my day job.
And the moon is your day job. Do you think we got to get to do you think we have to get to Mars by going to the moon first?
Not necessarily. This happens to be a good opportunity for me right now, where we can build some capability that'll let us do other space missions. But I don't see it as a prerequisite.
Wow, that's interesting. Joe, thanks for being on the program with us today and sharing what you're doing over there at UCF. And I think it's great, and I do see it, the whole Google Lunar X Prize, Central Florida, the home team. We all need to be behind you and do some more and get some more visibility of what you're doing. So thanks for being on the program today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. If you're ever over our way, feel free to swing by. We'll give you a tour.
Next time we have to go pay the rent on my son's dorm, we'll let you know, okay?
Sounds good.
Thanks, Joe. Take care now. Okay, that's it for now. Next week on Space Talk, we're going to be joined by some folks from Boeing's Satellite Systems Division who are involved with the production of the GPS satellites, well, that we all can't seem to live without these days. It's satellites and stuff like that, not something we really focused on the past in the past, on this program, how they make satellites, what goes on to get them ready to fly, what happens in orbit, how do they work, all those kind of questions. Well, we're going to answer those and more, as they say, on next week's exciting episode of Space Talk. I'm off to Rockledge right now, by the way, to join my wife at Trinity Lutheran Church and School, where she works as their office manager. We're going to be having their first ever trunk or treat activity. If you've never been to one, you ought to go. I'll be dressed up as Fred Flintstone. So if you ever want to see me dressed up as Fred Flintstone, there we're going to make it happen. We're giving away candy to kids, a free event from 5 to 7 on Fisk Boulevard in Rockledge. Your family invited. Come out and say hello. That is it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mila Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of our sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. Thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station. Join us next Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern, for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now for a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck Program.